Good morning. You're listening to 91.9 WDRT Viroqua Public Radio. We're here with Paul Rattay, and I'm Christina DeRocher. Paul Rattay is the skeptical naturopath. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Great.
You?
Good. January's over.
Too fast. So we're here to talk today about navigating the supplement maze, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to these days.
Oh, supplements. Yes. How many millions of Americans take supplements? I don't know. I think I saw the last number. It's like 55 billion. I hope I have that right. It's like 55 billion, 50 billion, something like that, and growing, each year.
Yes.
Gets bigger.
I believe that.
We spend a lot of money on supplements.
Jeez. So it is a maze because there's even less of a structure around it than there is pharmaceuticals.
Correct. So, and think about this. So we have a culture that we've been very much, I don't know if indoctrinated is the right word, that there's a fix. There's something that we take. Yes? So there's a pill.
Fix the problem.
There's a test. There's something we can do objectively to deal with whatever's going on. I mean, we could go back to antibiotics, right? Antibiotics, absolute gift for the human race, yes? We perhaps overuse them now, and we've developed resistance. It's like we're losing that sort of subjectivity of when to use them versus just saying, oh, this is the way we deal with it, right? So an antibiotic's gonna kill bacteria. And if you have a bacterial infection that's life-threatening, fantastic. So it's a good use, right? So that's something that we've now applied to everything else. So even if we talk about antivirals, so we want to still treat a virus similar to how we treat a bacteria. So we just kill the virus. But it's not quite the same. They're not the same entity. But then we can just take that to supplements as well. That now we get to the point that we're like, well, you know, an antibiotic has some side effects.
Right.
Yeah, and it's perhaps that I have an effect on my microbiome. I maybe killed the good bacteria. I don't want to kill the good bacteria. So, what's the natural antibiotic that I can use? So I don't want to use a, quote unquote, synthetic antibiotic. I'm going to use something that's more natural and use it in the same way that I'm using the antibiotic. But the thinking is the same, right?
Right.
So I'm taking something instead of saying, well, how do I make myself perhaps less susceptible to that? How do I strengthen my immune system, which may not be the same thing as killing a microbe, right? Killing a bacteria, killing a virus.
Right. You're starting from a different vantage point. How do I prevent these sort of occurrences from happening on a regular basis as opposed to, well, here are the symptoms. I'm going to treat the symptoms.
Right. And we now just try to apply that same thought process, right? We think that this is what we take and this is what it does. And this is demonstrable and reproducible. So now we just want to apply that to a supplement because we don't want to, quote unquote, take the drug. Or the drug's a controlled substance. Controlled substance. I mean, it's something that you need a script. Somebody controls that to say, here, we're going to prescribe this. Here's how you take it. And then people just, I don't want to do that. I want to do something natural. And then big supplement is just kind of right behind big pharma on this to say, oh, we've got a supplement for you. And here's something that you can buy. And you don't need a script for that. You can go to the health food store. You can go online. You can go to the naturopath. And they're going to give you something that's going to work just as well.
Okay.
So it's a replacement thing, right? And I'm not sure it's a replacement.
Oh, why not? I mean, I guess what I'm hearing from you is that we've just gone from synthetic to natural. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, right. Well, what's wrong with that? Does it work the same? Can we really compare a supplement? Is a supplement just a minor version of a drug?
I would imagine that it would take longer for it to, so to speak, set in or do its thing. If you use regular sugar in a pie, that's going to taste markedly different from if you use something like brown rice syrup, which has a different sweetness, a less intense sweetness. You probably have to use more of the brown rice syrup in order to get it to, you know, a regular sugar standard of sweetness. So do I have to do more supplements, or do I have to do it for longer, or?
Good question. Yes. So this leads to all the questions that we have, like, why are you taking a supplement? How do you take the supplement? And then, you know, how do you know it's working?
Right.
Do you just invest in it and say, I'm going to take vitamin D because vitamin D is good for my immune system and everybody's deficient and I need to take vitamin D. Or I need to take fish oil. So fish oil has all these wonderful properties, the EPA, DHA, the omega-3s that are in there, right? Essential fatty acids, we have to consume them. We can't make them. The question is, do we need 9 capsules of fish oil every day, or could we get away with, you know, taking a teaspoon of cod liver oil once every 3 weeks and get the same effect? Good question. Mm. Are we treating a deficiency? Are we treating an insufficiency? How much do we need? And then we try to say, now it has all these therapeutic properties. So vitamin D is good for the immune system. You need to take it. Fish oil is good for inflammation. And it's good to prevent cardiovascular disease. So I'm just going to take it. So those, it's kind of, you know, what I'm going to put in the category of a lifestyle supplement. Or what I, you know, in big pharma, you know, in the drug world, we talk about lifestyle drugs. So a lifestyle drug would be a drug that you need to take for the rest of your life.
Okay. Or you could even say vitamins, I would think, too, right? Aren't vitamins?
Yeah, supplements.
Kind of
like that? So when I say supplements, I'm going to put that as a big umbrella to include vitamins and minerals and accessory nutrients, right? Things that we aren't necessarily deficient in, we make it. Like coenzyme Q10 is an example of a accessory nutrient. It's not a vitamin because we make it in the liver. Hmm. But do we make enough of it? And if you take a statin drug to, you know, decrease your cholesterol, you may impact your liver's ability to make CoQ10. So maybe now CoQ10 becomes more vitamin-like, like we need it. It's essential.
Right.
When we take a statin drug, right? This gets all messy.
Yeah.
Yes. And
yeah.
Then so anyway, so when I say a supplement, I'm covering all that. I would include herbs as part of that. So herbal medicine.
Okay.
So it's a big umbrella term. Yes. And again, when we talk about vitamins, that those are essential, meaning that we have to consume them. We can't make them on our own. Minerals. Minerals we need also in various doses, right, to prevent quote-unquote deficiency. But the classic deficiencies are the vitamin deficiencies, right? Pellagra is a B vitamin deficiency, right? Beriberi, right? So those, scurvy, those are things that we see as the end result of a deficiency for a long period of time.
I'm sorry, every time I hear scurvy, I think of pirates, and then I have to giggle.
Arrgh, arrgh, matey. Well, they're limeys. You know the whole idea behind you. So scurvy was a big problem for sailors.
Right, vitamin C.
Vitamin C. And so how long can you go without vitamin C? And somebody figured out that they put a lime tree on board, and everybody gets a little squirt of lime juice, I don't know, once every week.
Yeah.
And they don't get scurvy. So they didn't, we didn't know what scurvy was. We knew what the symptoms were. I mean, I'd argue, I think I talked about this before, that native cultures kind of know what scurvy was. They probably had a name for it, but sure, they didn't know the mechanism. They didn't know the science behind it or the reductionistic science, but they knew, like, if we don't do this, we see these things happen, and that's not a good thing. But anyways, the limeys, so that was the way they figured out that they could prevent scurvy by, you know, having a lemon tree or a lime tree on board.
Wow. And so is anyone getting enough just from their primary diet? I don't know where this question came from, but, you know, you're talking about even the simple vitamins that we need. Does anyone get everything they need from food? Does everyone need to be on a supplement?
Yeah, a good question. So how much scurvy have I seen in clinical practice?
Probably not much.
None. I don't think so. So beriberi, pellagra, those are things that we don't see in this culture. We're not a very deficient culture. Plus, we do things to kind of prevent that. We fortify foods.
Right.
We've done that with B vitamins where we will add it. So we add it to processed grains. So if you refine grains, you're required to add folic acid to it, for example. So we don't see folic acid deficiency with pregnant women, right? Because the deal with folic acid in for pregnancy is you need it oftentimes before the woman even knows she's pregnant. It's to prevent neural tube defects. So the neural tube develops about right around the third week of pregnancy. So day 21, day 23, somewhere in that time frame. How many women know they're pregnant at day 21? They haven't missed a cycle yet.
Right.
So that's why we say, oh, if you're even able to get pregnant or you're thinking about getting pregnant, you should take a prenatal to make sure we have that. But as a culture, right, in America, and other cultures don't do this, where we fortify, where we require that by law, that if you're, you know, you've got a refined carbohydrate or you've got a, you know, flour that you put in something in cereal, what have you, that they've added the folic acid to it.
And is that a good quality?
Well, it's a synthetic form of that. It's folic acid versus dietary folate, so they're not exactly the same. But for all intents and purposes and preventing a neural tube defect, they work identically. I mean, this is a big thing, too, that there's food-based supplements.
Right.
So where is your vitamin C coming from, for example? Vitamin C, or what prevents scurvy, is ascorbic acid. Ascorbic acid, and you can synthesize that. You can make it from corn. You can, you know, we can do that. And much of what you buy over the counter is synthesized from that. Still ascorbic acid. It's actually more or less pure ascorbic acid.
You can't do much to it to make it.
Yeah, you could maybe have a lesser grade of it, I suppose. But for the most part, ascorbic acid is ascorbic acid. Whether I derive it from something, extract it from something, or whether I create it,
okay,
synthesize it. We'll be like, oh, well, we want natural vitamin C.
Right.
Well, I would then say then you want to, you know, consume acerola berry, right? So acerola berry would be a source of vitamin C. It's a berry.
Okay.
It's pretty expensive, too. You could buy powdered. That's kind of how I like to use it or take it. But then I would just say that's like a food. It's going to cost you more money than taking a vitamin C supplement. And if you're trying to get the same amount of vitamin C, you got to take more of it. But now it's a food construct, right? It's got other things in it. It's got bioflavonoids in it. It's got other components that we find when we eat the food that we don't get when we isolate the vitamin. Hmm. But to prevent scurvy, we need ascorbic acid. But ascorbic acid really doesn't come alone when you eat an orange or eat an acerola berry. You get other things with it. Mm-hmm. But those things don't prevent scurvy. Do you understand? This is reductionism.
Yes.
This is this whole idea of nutritionism that I get into, that we eat nutrients. We don't eat food.
Right.
We eat foods because they contain certain nutrients, and then we manipulate foods to make sure they have more of those nutrients. So how do you get almond milk that has more calcium than milk does? How's that possible?
You have to add it.
Yeah, they add it. They add it as a supplement. You can look at the label and they say tricalcium phosphate. I think that's the form they use. They just add it. It's just you're taking a calcium supplement along with your almond milk. But they put it in there and they say, oh, it's got more calcium than milk does. But it's not in context. It's out of context. Good, bad, I don't know. This is what we do as a culture. We get in there and manipulate it because there's a market for it. Because we know we need to drink milk to get calcium.
Right.
I mean, I see, you know, mom who brings in 3-year-old Johnny and says, hey, he's got recurrent otitis media, right, ongoing ear infections.
Okay.
And I say, well, how much dairy is he drinking? Oh, he drinks dairy all the time. And I may say, well, maybe he doesn't tolerate dairy. Maybe we just take dairy out for a month and see if that improves things, right? And it may not be. I'm just using that as an example. And what do you think the first thing she says is?
But he needs his calcium.
Yeah, he needs his calcium. So we're sold on that.
Mm-hmm,
yes,
mm-hmm.
And that's not true. It's not that that's false. But what about magnesium? What about potassium? What about iron? What about molybdenum? What about all these other things that we get as well? Like we've been trained on the calcium.
And is that marketing essentially?
Partly. I mean, understand the dairy industry is pretty. Well-established industry in the United States, yes, and
yes.
Calcium, and we've been relying on dairy products in this culture, right? That we come to America and we can raise cows, and it's a source of nutrition, and we don't have to kill the cow.
Mm-hmm.
We get butter, we get milk, we get eggs from chickens, and we can maintain those, and we don't have to kill the animal where we don't get that any longer. So there's been a, you know, high incentive that's been something that we can live on, right? Native Americans didn't have cows. Dairy products.
And so where did they get their calcium from?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. Wow, now they need to start drinking milk because they, you know, we now know that you need your calcium. Wait, but you've been living here for 5,000 years and you've kind of adapted to that. And anyway, so but the dairy industry, and calcium is in dairy, so it helps them sell more dairy, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Where's your mustache?
Right.
I mean, how many women have I seen with osteoporosis? And generally, my patient base usually know things. And they've already been taking calcium. They've been taking calcium for 30 years. They've been taking 1,200 milligrams of calcium for 20, 30 years.
And they still come in.
Because they know it. And they come in and they have osteoporosis. You're like, oh, well, I thought calcium prevents that. If you have a calcium deficiency, it's a problem. And it can lead to this. It increases the risk of that. But it's more than a calcium deficiency.
Osteoporosis is.
Yeah, it's a metabolic disorder, of which calcium is one piece to that, and of which everybody knows that we need to take calcium, so take your calcium.
So why don't we hear more about osteoporosis being more than a calcium deficiency? This is the first time I'm hearing of it, actually.
I don't know. And osteoporosis is, you know, loss of bone mass.
And understand, it's very common.
Oh, yeah, very common. Osteopenia and then osteoporosis.
Right.
And really what I'm more concerned about is maybe not even osteoporosis, but what I call sarcopenia. So sarcopenia instead of osteopenia. So sarcopenia is loss of muscle mass. Mm. And they'll have this on the news like once a year or something. They'll say, oh, the disease of aging.
Oh.
It's sarcopenia. And how do you cure it? How do you prevent sarcopenia? What do you think?
I know that people, you know, I'm getting there myself, and I know people are telling me that I need to start lifting weights and doing minor stretches every day.
Ah.
I need to work my muscles more than I did when I was younger.
You got to use it or lose it.
Right.
But that's harder. I want to take a pill.
I know.
Yeah,
so
give me
why.
The pill. Yeah, the pill
I don't
works
even like
better.
Pills.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't I go there? And sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass. So what do we really care about in osteoporosis? What is the deal breaker? I mean, I see women fear of God with osteoporosis.
Breaking your hip.
Breaking your hip. Mm-hmm. You could break your clavicle as well. I'm not so concerned about your clavicle because it doesn't increase your morbidity and mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking your hip does.
Right.
Big deal.
Right.
So we care about the hip fracture.
Yes.
So how do you prevent a hip fracture? Well, having more bone is better, yes?
Correct.
But also understand that how much bone did you have to start with? Men lose bone just as quickly as women do. It's just men have a lot more bone to start with.
Hmm.
So they got longer to go before that really manifests. So understand that I may have a woman with big bones and then I may have a woman with not so big bones. And then we do your bone density scan based on the quote-unquote normal, I don't know, 28-year-old woman. Like, who's this normal 28-year-old woman? Wouldn't we want to know where you were at 28? But so understand there's some individual variation that goes into this. And then we say you have osteopenia or osteoporosis. Again, not that that's bad or good, but what do you do about it? And then it's going to be like, well, take your calcium, take your vitamin D. Here, maybe take some medications for that. But perhaps if I want to prevent a hip fracture, what are some other things to think about here?
I mean, I'm eating on a regular basis.
Okay, am I getting enough protein to build the muscle that I need? I mean, how about the tea and toast diet as we get older, right? Tea and toast diet, you don't eat enough protein. This is my story with my mom, right? Every time I see my mom, it's almost like it's on her agenda. Oh, I'm getting enough protein, right? Because I ask her about this. And she's now just like trained to say.
She's going
to
mention it before you do.
Yeah, and she's drinking Ensure, you know, which, okay, it's protein, but it's not food based. I mean, is this a food? Is protein? I'm like, Mom, I want you to eat some chicken, eat some eggs, right? Eat some tofu. And tofu, they're not going to go over with her. But, you know, it's this kind of thing. So, again, having enough protein, that's a choice you make.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece is, do you use the muscle or do you lose it? I go in her kitchen and I see the slippery, you know, mat that she could slip on.
Right.
It goes out with me. I don't even tell her any longer. I just take it.
Yeah.
She's like, Paul, did you see my little carpet that?
I don't know what you're talking about, Mom.
Where it went.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening to 91.9 WDRT in Viroqua Public Radio. We're here with Paul Rattay, the Skeptical Naturopath. I'd like to take a few moments here and tell you about Paul Rattay's monthly lectures called Obstacles to Cure. So every second Saturday morning of the month, he gives a one-hour lecture, and there's a half-an-hour Q&A beforehand, and it's at the Commons on Jefferson Street in Viroqua. And it is Saturday, March 11th will be the third lecture of this year-long series, and it's called The Art of Concentrating Empty Calories, Refined Carbohydrates. So we hope to see you there.
Yeah, that's next month's
Right.
Radio show.
February's was just yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. So now if you went yesterday, now you're getting a refresher on this. Yes, you could see how I did.
Right.
And I'm sure it's completely different than what I actually talked about.
Sure.
Anyway, so this is just a perfect example with calcium and how we're led to believe that, you know, we need to take these things. And it's not that calcium's not important, but how many of us are deficient? And then we get to this whole idea that taking supplements just leads to expensive urine. Right, this is going to be kind of the conventional thought process on this, right? You take supplements, it's just a waste of money.
Right. You just let it go. Your body doesn't understand.
I'm not so worried about the expensive urine. And again, expensive is all relative. Yes, I mean, you could take calcium. Calcium's not that much money, right? You take a B vitamin, for example. B vitamin's the classic. If you take a B vitamin, your urine turns like bright yellow, green even, mm-hmm. right? That's called flavinuria because you're getting more riboflavin than you need.
And your body's excreting the rest of
it. And your body's excreting it. But you absorbed it, and you gave your body the opportunity to say, oh, well, I got a lot of riboflavin here. It's way more than I need, so I'm going to pitch it.
Mm.
Is that a bad thing? Yeah, I mean, you're taking more riboflavin than you need. You're kind of hedging your bets and saying, well, I'm just going to take a B-complex. I mean, you take a B-complex, it probably cost you, I don't know, 10 cents a day? I don't know, right? I have to do the math on that. But so is it expensive urine? I guess. I mean, it's 10 cents a day, maybe 15 cents. I mean, if it was a really expensive supplement. But understand, the urine is at least that you absorbed it, and then your body had a choice to say, I don't need it.
And how do you know? How do you know you're absorbing it?
Good question. How do we know? Because what I'm more interested in is expensive stool.
Okay, that's not being absorbed.
Because that's not being absorbed. And this is what I worry about with calcium, for example. Right? We just use calcium as the example here. So there's different forms of calcium. Right? There's calcium. So when you take a mineral, so the whole idea is you consume a mineral, it's always in a salt form. It's bound to something. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's calcium carbonate, for example, which is limestone. That's what it's derived from. You could take limestone. You could shave off some limestone and take it. That's calcium carbonate.
Wow.
It's not any different than what they put in the capsule, wherever they get the source from, right? It's a salt.
Okay.
And wherever it's derived from, you take bone meal and grind bones down, and you get calcium carbonate from that. Or actually, it's hydroxyapatite. Calcium phosphate is what you get from bones. So, but anyway, so those are, you get a certain amount of elemental calcium. Right? Calcium carbonate limestone is an excellent source of calcium. The problem is it's bound with carbonate. Right? So whenever you take a mineral, it's always never going to come as just calcium, just magnesium, just iron. It's bound to something.
Even in the case of seaweed?
Even in the case of seaweed, because how it exists in nature is not in its ion form. It's not ionized. It's going to be as a complex. Like bone meal, for example, is calcium phosphate.
Oh, okay.
So even bone meal, you've still got to separate that. I mean, you want a good source of calcium, I'd say eat sardines that have the bones in them, right? I mean, that's a great source of calcium. Anyways, so calcium carbonate. So in our digestive tract, we have to ionize it. We have to separate the calcium from whatever it's bound to. And then once it's ionized, then that's what we absorb. And that's what we use. Right, so this whole ionization process is something that happens in the stomach. We need hydrochloric acid. We need digestive enzymes. We need these things to really play a role in the ionization of it. So calcium carbonate has a lot of elemental calcium in it, but it's a little bit less bioavailable than the organic forms, organic, inorganic. I don't mean organic and like clean, just what it's bound to, like calcium citrate. Calcium citrate malate. Those are different forms. So the citrate or the malate is what we consider to be an organic form versus calcium carbonate, which is an inorganic form. Again, understand that I'm not talking about it's organic and it's good for you. It's clean. It's that kind of, it's just.
You're talking about bioavailability.
Yeah, bioavailability.
Okay.
And so the calcium carbonate, we have to ionize it and be able to absorb it. And when we have good, strong stomach acid, we can do that. So if I have a 20-year-old who eats whatever they want, I mean, they could probably take all the limestone that they want, all the calcium carbonate, they're going to ionize it, and they'll be able to absorb much of it. But understand, we also get to a level on mineral absorption that we will absorb a lot to a certain level, and then we kind of stop. It's like this learning curve or absorption curve, like it goes like this. Like you absorb the first 300 milligrams really well, but then after 300 milligrams, the absorption starts to decrease.
Because you're getting older, or you're talking on a daily basis?
No, just this happens anyways. This happens with vitamin C. This happens with calcium. It's just an absorption range. So in other words, to get, and I don't quote me on these numbers, but sure, let's say the first 300 milligrams of calcium is well absorbed, that you may absorb, you know, 90% of that. Then as you take another 100 or another 200 with it, then the absorption starts to go down, right? So that perhaps taking 600 versus 300 milligrams of calcium, you're not getting 300 more from the 600, right? Because the absorption decreases.
Interesting.
So already this gets to the how you take the supplement. So taking that supplement all at once may not be the same as splitting it up between meals.
Is that why some supplements, especially if they're in liquid form, tell you to take it twice a day, 20 drops in the morning and 20 drops in the evening?
Yeah, perhaps. And that's it, try to improve absorption as well. Because for the most part, supplements, not always, there's exceptions here, but should be taken with food.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you're absorbing it like a food, so when you be absorbing food, you're going to absorb the whatever you're taking as a supplement along with it. I mean, there's the, of course, the story with the fat-soluble vitamins. Maybe you've heard this, that if you eat a salad that's got lots of, you know, beta-carotene, right, so vitamin A precursor, you know, carrots and all those colorful vegetables, that if you eat a low-fat salad, right, there's no fat in the salad, you don't absorb those fat-soluble vitamins very well.
Oh.
So it's better to put some olive oil as salad dressing on that, because it's going to increase the absorption of the beta-carotene that's in the colored vegetables that you're eating.
Oh, my.
It's just messy, yes?
Yes.
And then you're like, oh, what do I do?
Who knew? But, I thought I was, yeah, I mean, I actually do eat salad with dressing, but the healthier person is saying, I do the very bare minimum of salad dressing, or I don't eat any salad dressing. You know what I mean?
And then you don't get as well absorption. Oh. I can't say that you don't absorb any of it. I'm
right.
just going to say it's decreased.
Right.
Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So if you take vitamin D, it really needs to be taken with a meal that has fat in it. It needs to be consumed with fat because it's going to increase the absorption of the fat-soluble vitamins, right? So this vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin K, any of those are going to require some fat. So if you're completely fat-phobic, you know, and you just take the supplement, you may not even absorb the supplement as well. You need some fat in there.
Okay.
Anyway, so back to the absorption, right? So calcium carbonate, lots of calcium in it, but you have to ionize, and it's a little bit more taxing on the body to be able to make it more bioavailable. Or you need the hydrochloric acid. And generally, as we age, our hydrochloric acid status goes down.
Sure.
Right? Perhaps why my mom doesn't eat protein, because she may not digest it well, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Right? She won't tell me. Nah, that's a whole other story I can get into. We'll just stop there, right, TMI. So the idea is that we need that ionization. We need that strong stomach acid to be able to take that limestone and extract the calcium from it and absorb that. So as we get older, maybe we don't do that as well, and we take calcium carbonate, and we could say, oh, well, maybe I need to take a more bioavailable form, like calcium citrate malate, for example. And again, it's not like it's absorbed 200 times better than calcium carbonate, right? I would say it's more like perhaps 20 to 30%, right? Instead of like, oh my gosh, it's night and day.
Mm-hmm.
But it still has, let's say, better bioavailability. It's more easily ionized in the digestive system. The problem is that you got to take a lot more of those pills to equal what you get in the calcium carbonate.
Why?
So calcium carbonate, you can go to the health food store and find a big old calcium carbonate pill, right? Big old horse pill, and you'll easily get 600 milligrams of calcium in that, perhaps even 750 in one pill. So you could say, oh, I need to get 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day, so I take two horse pills.
Sure.
And hopefully you would take the horse pill in the morning and at night and don't take both horse pills at the same time, right? Just like I said earlier, better to space it out than get it all at once, because your absorption is going to decrease if you at a certain level, right? But if you space it out, then perhaps that's better, right? Or better absorption. Okay, so you go to the health food store and you say, okay, well, calcium carbonate, I need 1,200 milligrams of calcium. And then you look and say, oh, well, here's a more bioavailable form. Well, here's calcium citrate malate. Problem is, you probably got to take four or five pills to equal the one horse pill that you took. Hmm. Plus, you're taking five pills. What's the cost of calcium carbonate going to be compared to taking the cost of calcium citrate malate? It's going to be a lot cheaper to take calcium carbonate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, if you have a strong digestive system, I don't care. Take calcium carbonate. but split it in doses and don't take it all at once. But if you're older, maybe we need to use a more available form. But understand, this is about what's getting in the bloodstream. Just because you take it doesn't necessarily translate to that's what's in my bloodstream. This is the expensive stool part, right? So you can, I mean, I don't know, they've done studies on this, but you find calcium remnants in the stool because you didn't absorb it.
Right.
Now that's a problem.
Right.
But perhaps it's based on the fact that I'm trying to get everything that I need in one pill, and this is the cheap way to do it, and so that's what I do, instead of saying, perhaps I need smaller doses more frequently of a more bioavailable version. Mm. And again, this depends on the person.
Right.
Not just, everybody needs 1,200 milligrams of calcium, but that's what the Food and Nutrition Board says.
Right.
So they say, here's what you need. It's not necessarily what's being absorbed. So again, N of 1.
N of 1. I was just going to
say. I got to look at the person and say, you have a digestive issue here. I'm really going to choose. I think that this would be a better source than this.
Right.
But then again, we're only looking at calcium. And again, I think most people know now, I need vitamin D along with the calcium. So the supplement has vitamin D and calcium in it. And then maybe vitamin K. Vitamin K is kind of the new up-and-coming sexy vitamin that's making K2 specifically, yes. We have to include that in that, right? So some more forward thinking. I don't ever know forward thinking. I've been in this field a long time. I've seen a lot of supplements come out with a lot of hype, and then it's kind of like wah, wah, wah after a period of time, yes?
And what do you think about that? What is your experience, even personally? How do you look at your life and look at what you may need and decide if it's the sexy new supplement or if there's actually something to it? How do we know? This comes into, who's your expert?
Who do you listen to? Where is your resource? What resource do you go to? And who are you going to trust? Are you going to go to the medical doctor? And the medical doctors, I mean, I'm going to say, and it's not biased, but they're going to say, hey, show me the evidence.
Right.
I want to see some evidence, and I will tell you that calcium is important, and kind of the things that the Food and Nutrition Board are going to say, but they're not going to think outside the box very much. And then you come and see me, and I'm like, you need to take this, and this, right? I mean, and I can, I could quote the literature and tell you, here's the things that you need to take, but really, what do you really need to take? Do I see a woman and say, boy, it's calcium and vitamin D that are really essential for you? I'm going to take a step back and say, how are you absorbing? What's going on in the digestive tract? Are you getting enough protein? Because what do you think bone's made of? Is bone just a mineral? No, it's made of protein, a substantial amount of protein. Are you eating enough protein? This is, again, why I harp on my mother. Does she have enough protein to actually make healthy bone? And then we just look at the RDA of protein. Yes, the RDA is 0.8 grams per kilogram desirable body weight.
It's hardly anything.
It's hardly anything, but that's the amount that you need to prevent deficiency. So you don't walk around with kwashiorkor. Kwashiorkor is in Africa where usually the firstborn is protein deficient and they have a protruded belly.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's a protein deficiency. So getting 0.8 grams per kilogram desirable body weight is enough to prevent that. But it may not be your optimal level. I mean, you bring in a bodybuilder here, we could talk about that. They'll tell you, oh, my God, RDA?
That's not enough.
I'm like 6 times that.
Yeah.
Because I'm actively doing something to build muscle mass. Because they're doing something. So somehow we think, we just eat it. Right? So I want my mother also doing things to, figure out her balance, do some Tai Chi, do, these kinds of things to make her more stable when she takes a step and have enough muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. We're led down the supplement road because it's easy and it's a consumer, right? We're a consumer and it's like, what do I need to buy to create health? So I can buy my health in a health food store. Or I can buy health in, my clinic. You come in and, I don't want to change my diet.
Or my lifestyle.
I just want to take fish oil and still eat at McDonald's. Whatever. I mean, I'm going to say, perhaps the eating less at McDonald's is more important than you taking fish oil, right? Thus my lecture series, right? Obstacles to cure. What are you doing that's in the way instead of what do you have to take for this? We've been led in this deficiency road, right? I mean, nutrition got its glamour from deficiencies, from pellagra, from scurvy,
and you're mentioning real life situations, they're all pretty old, so to speak, right? Scurvy and pellagra. I mean,
yeah, which we really don't see so much, though we saw pellagra after the Civil War in the early 1900s as well down south.
Right, but we're still talking about over 100 years ago now.
Yeah, for the most part. And we're generally not deficient.
So this is really, that's really important to note. We're really not deficient, and there's this shift from, you know, medical doctor, tell me what I need to take, to, well, it's just fine to go to Paul Rite and ask him what I should take. You know what I mean? We're sort of trading off one expert for another without taking on the responsibility. I'm just trying to highlight a couple of really important points to what you're talking about. All of these details about calcium specifically are really interesting, but the overarching theory that I'm hearing you say is we are not really deficient. And so maybe reading about women's health or men's health in the magazines is one way of getting some information about the sexy new supplements and things like that. But we really need to do this N of one and ask ourselves what our biography is, what our lifestyle is like, what we're eating, take on this bigger picture, right?
Yeah. For example, they've done studies and they've looked at people that take multivitamins. And they find that, I guess there's varying results on this kind of thing, but for the most part, multivitamins don't do much. But the whole idea is it's not the multivitamin that's doing it, it's the kind of person that takes a multivitamin. So if you're the kind of the person that's going to go and buy a nutritional supplement, mm-hmm. that perhaps you're doing other things that are beneficial for your health. You're exercising, you're more conscious of your diet, you're paying attention to these things, and that's what's important. So be the kind of person that goes and buys the supplement, buys the multivitamin, but don't buy it.
Right. Oh, right? My gosh. Wow.
Now, that being said, I mean, not that there's not deficiencies. Iron deficiency is for sure a big deal, yes? But now this is kind of the flip side of that. So this is the idea what supplements bring to the table is at least gives you some agency to say, hey, maybe I can do something before it turns into something else.
Okay, this is a great thread. I just want to take a break for a moment to thank our listeners for listening to 91.9 WDRT here in Viroqua Public Radio. We're here with Paul Rite, the skeptical naturopath. He has a monthly lecture series going on for a year, for the year of 2023. His third lecture of Obstacles to Cure will be on Saturday, March 11th from 8:30 in the morning until 10 a.m., at the Commons on Jefferson Street, and he has a Q&A from 8:30 to 9, and then he'll give a one-hour lecture. The lecture on Saturday, March 11th is Refined Carbohydrates, the Art of Concentrating Empty Calories. And this is free, correct?
Yes.
All right. So this is great. Where did we just leave off? That's a lot of information.
Oh, sorry, in transition to actual deficiencies.
Right. So I wanted to make a quick apology. It was a blanket statement to say we're not deficient. That's actually not, I mean, that's a huge blanket statement that I made. But what you were saying is as a society, as opposed to 100 to 200 years ago, in general, the standard American is not hugely deficient across the board the way we may have been before we even understood science and nutrition enough to say, you know, this is the issue and this is what we need to do, and right, it's a different landscape, which is not to say that individuals do not have deficiencies that they need to address.
Yeah, but it's always, again, the N of one. So I see a woman who has a really heavy menstrual cycle, I'm really worried about iron deficiency. Yes, so this is now, because I know the context of the situation, to say, hey, we need to look at this. And then what's curious is she may get, you know, a CBC, you know, blood test, and it says, oh, well, you're not anemic. Where you look at hematocrit and hemoglobin, right? And they say, oh, well, you're not anemic. And I look at that, and they may be on the low end of normal. And I say, well, I'm worried. You're a heavy bleeder, and I would think that iron may be beneficial for you because you bleed, whereas in a man who doesn't bleed, I may not do that. I wouldn't recommend that. But then the whole idea is that maybe she has pre-anemia, right? So for example, you can then test her iron storage, right? You test something called ferritin, and her ferritin may be low normal or maybe low. She's not anemic yet, but she's on her way to anemia, right? She's depleting her resources. She's depleting her, you know, her savings
store.
Account.
Yeah.
And I want to know that sooner, right? Instead of waiting until the point is, wow, you're really deficient. You need a blood transfusion. And that happens, of course, too. But this is the idea, again, the context of knowing, you have a really heavy menstrual cycle. We really need to consider this. And not that conventional medicine doesn't do that, too. But the whole idea is that let's work on this early. We don't need to let this go for 10, 20 years to say, now you need to think about this. Right. So then I would say, I think iron supplementation is a good thing. Problem with iron supplementation is it causes a lot of GI distress. So women that take iron often find that they get constipated and they have GI, you know, they feel bloated, you know, this kind of thing. They don't absorb it real well. So now we're in this whole merry-go-round of trying to find a form of iron that's more, quote unquote, bioavailable. And sometimes it could be a supplement. Sometimes it's blackstrap molasses, right? Blackstrap molasses is an example of something that has a fair amount of iron, or eating heme iron, which means it comes from an animal source.
Mm.
But again, this is kind of the conversation that I have to have with a patient to say, okay, so how do we deal with this? Perhaps it's an insufficiency rather than a deficiency, right? Or do we wait till you get deficient?
Right.
So this
hopefully
is
not.
Right. And so it's a spectrum kind of thing. Whereas I would say, yeah, I think vitamin D, we've been insufficient for a period of time, based on kind of how we approached it and our fear of fat and this kind of thing. But now we're sort of making up for and saying, oh, well, everybody's deficient. Of course, you need to take 5,000 international units of vitamin D every day. I don't know. You know, that's actually above the upper limit. That 5,000 a day is the upper limit in the United States of Food and Nutrition Board. And again, do I trust them and say, oh, they're the gurus? But they do look at the literature, right? They look at the literature and they get together and they have their consensus statement of what they think is, you know, what recommendations they would make. But they say 4,000 IU is the upper limit of vitamin D, meaning if you're taking above 4,000, there's a potential for toxicity.
Wow.
And there is.
Wow.
And I mean, when I went to medical school 25 plus years ago, I mean, I was afraid to give fish oil or cod liver oil. I was using cod liver oil in the summer because I was worried about making people vitamin D toxic. This is what I learned in school because that was our framework on that. And that's like 1,200 international units that you get from a teaspoon of cod liver oil that I was still worried I was going to cause somebody to go toxic. And now we're just running out taking 5,000. I mean, things have changed.
Yeah.
And granted, yes, I think that I was, you know, wrong in my thinking early on, but now we're just kind of going flip side and saying, well, everybody's deficient, instead of who's deficient and who really needs it, instead of this blanket statement of everybody takes 5,000 IUs of vitamin D. I mean, how many people come in and see me? They're taking 5,000 internet. I don't have to tell them. They're already taking it. I'm like, well, have you at least tested your levels or tested your calcium? Because calcium is actually the marker you look at for vitamin D toxicity. But, you know, just because it's potential toxicity on it. But vitamin D is cheap. It's no big deal. They just kind of take it and, oh, it's good for my immune system. I'm like, okay. I mean, I don't take vitamin D on a regular basis. When I'm sick, I take a huge dose for 3 days. That's what I do. That's my approach to that. But to just say I'm going to blanket statement 5,000 international units of vitamin D every day, I don't know. Plus, are you getting in your food source, right? Which would be another good conversation to have now, right? Can I just get it from food?
Right.
Why am I taking the supplement?
Yeah.
Like, where does vitamin D come from?
Yeah, where does it come from? I know we add it to milk.
So why do we add it to milk? But interesting, we don't add it to whole milk. If you look at whole milk, you buy whole milk, it does not say vitamin A and D fortified.
Really? I did not know that, actually.
Yeah. Dude, look at a bottle. It's not fortified. Why? Because it's in it.
It's in it.
It's in the fat in the milk.
So when we take the fat out of the milk, we have to add the supplement.
Oh, but the fat's the bad guy. You need the vitamin A and the vitamin D, so we're going to put it back in there. Oh, my goodness. Now I'm trusting the food industry to make these choices for me. I don't know. I tend to go with nature on this one, yes?
Yes, right, right. And how much are they putting back in? And is it fat soluble now if they've taken, I mean, skim milk, for instance? I mean,
it's not in a context of how much are you going to absorb?
Right.
So you still need some fat to be able to absorb that properly.
Huh.
But that's not the conversation we have. It's just like, it's in there, right? We measure the milk and here's what it has. And it's identical to full fat milk. But yet the context of it is perhaps different, that you may not get the same thing.
Scientific reductionist thinking.
Yes. So vitamin D, where do we get it?
I don't know.
Fat.
Oh, fat itself.
Animal fat.
Okay.
If you don't eat animal fat.
Oh, we did have this conversation. Yes.
If you don't eat animal fat, you don't get vitamin D. You can eat coconut oil. Coconut oil is high saturated fat, but zero vitamin D. And vitamin D is actually a, you know, it's a form of a steroid. It's a steroid hormone. Steroid means that it's made from cholesterol. Yes? Wow. So vitamin D, we get it from the sun. And is it just like our pores open up and we get the sunlight and vitamin D just like soaks in?
I think that's what a lot of people think.
Yeah, I know, but that's not what happens. So what happens is you have cholesterol in your bloodstream. And cholesterol circulating, and it comes in contact with UVB rays. UVB rays from the sun, those are the rays that potentially burn you. So UVB activates, it converts, hydroxylates the cholesterol that's circulating in your bloodstream, right, because of the sun exposure to your skin. Converts it into a form that then now is activated. It's not an active vitamin D, but now your liver and kidney can go further with that and use it as a substrate to make vitamin D. So sunlight will provide it, but that's still given that you have cholesterol in your bloodstream. Interesting, we think about this, like how many people have high cholesterol, and then we treat the cholesterol, and if we potentially treat the cholesterol, does that maybe impact our vitamin D levels? Well, maybe. I mean, again, people's cholesterol don't go down to zero, but I'm just saying we manipulate on so many different levels, and then we need those UVB rays. Yeah, so that's what does it. So if you don't eat any animal fat, you can get it from the sun. The problem is what do you get from the sun in, you know, Wisconsin in February?
Or I was thinking about Alaskans as well, right? With not a lot of sun for, and then they're eating the blubber and, you know what I'm saying? Like the Inuit culture, there's a lot of fat in their diet. So they're very smart in that sense. That
and look at their skin color. So think about that, right? So skin color. So if you're white,
they're
not pale. So white skin is like, I'm going to absorb every single ray of sunshine that I can get. I'm going to suck it all up. Yes.
Right.
And you burn easily, that kind of thing. But you're trying to get it from the sun. Whereas if you're dark skinned, you're not getting it as much. So is there some adaptation based on what our diet's been? And again, it's not going to be in one generation or two generations, but very interesting to look at that. But so, yeah, you're not going to find many low-fat Inuit diets because it's just that's not what's provided to them. They have to eat fat. But if you live at the equator, you've got constant vitamin D all year round.
Right. So are Floridians who are eating vitamin D like it's going out of style, they're actually not taking into consideration their... You know, I mean, the typical...
Well, but if they're fear of the sun, though, right? So if you're fear of the sun, you wear a sunscreen. SPF of 3 or greater, you're going to block vitamin D.
Okay.
So, so this is the idea that, you know, are we afraid of the sun? Do we need the sun? I don't know, right? Burning is not a good thing.
We've established that, I think.
Yeah. So, but the whole idea is having some sun exposure is a good thing, right? I mean, it's a signal to us. Right? And it's not just vitamin D. It's also a signal that it's daytime, that we're on a sleep-wake cycle. All these, there's beneficial properties of the sun that cue us in to, you know, life and how we spend our energy and live our life and our metabolism is all based on the circadian rhythm. And the sun is a big part of that. Anyways, so the idea is vitamin D, either you can eat it or you can get it from the sun. So again, in Wisconsin, guess how much vitamin D we get from the sun today, February? Zippo, nada. We're vitamin D winter, so not till, what, end of April? Again, potential to burn. If you don't have the potential to burn, you will not get vitamin D. So even in midsummer, you're like, oh, I'm going to take a walk at 7 in the morning till 8 till 9 when the sun's not so high. You're also not getting any UVB rays, right? It's the angle at the sun's at that's going to determine whether you get the UVB or not.
Interesting.
So that's the idea that, oh, wow, I actually got to be out there when I can burn. But, yeah, maybe 10 minutes. So go out in the sun for 10 minutes, then put your sunscreen on.
Yeah.
If that's the case, right? I don't want you to burn.
Right.
And then this leads to the next question, right? Can you get vitamin D from a tanning bed?
I did say no.
Yeah,
but you can
you can burn. There's UVB rays from a tanning bed. So it's UVB rays, right? That's what it is.
Right.
It's not vitamin D in the sun. It's nothing to do with the sun. It has to do with the form of cholesterol in your bloodstream. Anyways, so the whole idea with vitamin D is like everybody needs it, but should we be getting it in our diet? Or how much is it from the sun? And what's the right balance there? And if you're completely fat phobic, then then you won't be getting it from the animal fat, or if you don't eat any animal fat, then you're relying upon the sun. But the other thing is we do store vitamin D. So you could store it up and use it over a period of time, right? Which is unlike the water-soluble vitamins, like vitamin C and the B vitamins, which we need a regular source of that. Mm-hmm. We don't need as much, but we need to get it on a regular basis because we really don't store it, right? So there's some variations between the different vitamins, right? Is it fat-soluble? Is it water-soluble? Water-soluble is easier to absorb. Fat soluble is a little bit more difficult to absorb, but the fat soluble sticks around in your body longer, so you don't need to take it. I mean, you take vitamin D once a month because you store it, as long as you absorb that dose that you took. Fish oil, too, same thing. You can take it, once a week. Hmm. But we just get in this rhythm that we need to take it every day.
Well, yeah. I mean, sometimes it's easier to just remember to take it every day as opposed to forgetting once a month.
Yes, exactly, right? So there's a compliance issue with this.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, well, we still have a few more minutes. Do you want to bring up another topic within this realm?
Sure. So the next thing is, how do you know they're working? Yeah, so maybe I'll just sort of end with this, kind of what I call backdoor versus front door medicine, right? So supplements really don't work the same way as drugs do. So if we're looking at supplements as being a drug replacement, I don't know if that's the right way to think about it. So to know if it's working, am I taking this for a specific reason, right? I mentioned earlier about lifestyle drugs or lifestyle supplements. Mm-hmm. So you just take vitamin D for the rest of your life. You just take fish oil for the rest of your life. You just take a statin drug for the rest of your life. If you're pre-diabetic, you just take metformin for the rest of your life, right? No questions. Now understand that the supplement industry and the drug industry certainly like lifestyle drugs and lifestyle supplements, because you don't have any endpoint.
Right.
You just take it.
Right.
There's no questions asked because this is what you need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, all right. So how do we know that fish oil works? How do we know that vitamin D works? I mean, at the very least, you can test vitamin D and kind of see, and people may overinterpret those results. And for the most part, I'd be like, I don't know that you need 5,000 on a regular basis. So are we just preventing the deficiency that we can do a test on? Fish oil, a little bit more difficult because we can test, but the test isn't so conclusive on that. It's not as good as a vitamin D test. And how do we know what our levels are at? How do we know what the optimal dose is? And how do we know that it's actually preventing cardiovascular disease or it's anti-inflammatory? I'm going to tell you, I look at the literature, right? It's part of what I do, right? I teach nutrition, so I look at it. I'm going to tell you, fish oil literature, fish oil research, all over the board. Right, there's research that says there's no benefit. There's research that says benefit.
Wow.
So what do we do with that? And there's unfortunately some cherry picking that goes on. There's confirmation bias that happens when they do these big meta-analyses. That's a whole nother story to talk about. But I'm going to tell you that, does fish oil prevent cardiovascular disease? The best I can tell you is maybe. Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, I can't give you a definitive answer on this. How beneficial is it for inflammation as an anti-inflammatory? I mean, I've seen people where I've given them high-dose fish oil and turmeric and GLA as a means to say, hey, let's try this. I'm going to call this front-door medicine to see if this has any effect on your rheumatoid arthritis in the next month. So this now is basically an experiment, a four-week experiment or whatever, whatever we decide upon that we're going to do for 4 weeks and say, hey, is your inflammation better? Yes, no, maybe, kind of, sort of, maybe a little bit, right? And it's not going to work as well as a conventional anti-inflammatory, but maybe we just run that trial, but we're doing it for 4 weeks instead of being like, oh, well, I got to just take this for 3 years.
And is everything like that?
It's front door, back door. So front door means I'm doing this for inflammation. I have active inflammation. I want to know if it works. Preventing cardiovascular disease is now a big, long, drawn-out question. You're like, well, of course I'm going to take my fish oil. Of course I'm going to take vitamin D because I'm worried about my immune system. And be like, well, if you're worried about your immune system, what's your exercise look like? Are you outside walking every day? What's your diet like? Yes, instead of, oh, I take my vitamin D. Because vitamin D is easy. Fish oil is easy. But again, what is our desired results?
Okay. So for something more finite or acute, you would say, there can be some movement because you've got this issue, and then you can look at the issue after a short period of time, even, or at least, you know, keep looking at it. But if it's a bigger, long-term thing, you really have to think about what you're doing to support yourself in all other angles as well.
Exactly. And then you got to look at risk-benefit. Risk is maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. Costs money, right? And these are all the things that we talk about, right? So there's certain things that I take. I tell you what my supplements I take. Do we have enough time?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll tell you my supplement plan, right? And again, I'm not a very good doctor to myself, right? Because I come up with a new supplement plan all the time. And I'm, you know, I got a big old target on my back. I see the new supplements. I'm like, oh, wow, maybe that's the latest, greatest, brand new is going to prevent all these things, right? I know this. I've heard it a million times. So I'm a little bit more skeptical. On this. But the things that I do take, so I take calcium, magnesium, potassium every day. So I take a supplement that contains calcium, magnesium, and potassium on it, and I take a fair amount of that.
What's a fair amount?
Fair amount means it's probably, let's see, I take six capsules, so I'm getting probably about 450 of calcium, 450 of magnesium, and probably 300 of potassium. But I take those in divided doses, so that's just a mineral supplement that I take. I also take glutathione. So glutathione is completely backdoor therapy for me because glutathione is a body's antioxidant. You make the antioxidant. So I'm hedging my bets to say I'm willing to spend the money to just think that I may get some glutathione that's useful to help as an antioxidant. I can't prove to you that that's the case, but I just do it.
And again, it supports your lifestyle, too, of I do these things. I care about myself. But and then maybe it's helping you to choose better things in your lifestyle as well.
Maybe, but I have no idea. I can't tell you that. Sure. I know that it works.
Sure.
The other thing, I take a CogniAid, right? So I take something that's cognitive function. It's got wild blueberry, and it's got, you know, other things in it to help with my cognitive function because I know my parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so
mm-hmm.
I know what goes on with the 30 years in advance.
Taking in your end-of-life history.
Exactly. I'm going to look at that and say, I think it's well worth me to invest in this and just take this every day. And yeah, it costs money, but I'm willing to say this is a reason that I do that. I take a liver supplement, so I basically kind of rotate through different herbs that I use to work on liver function. So I'm a naturopath. I mean, medical school day two, it's all about the liver, right? And your ability to detoxify things in the environment. So partly why I take glutathione, but also that I'm doing things to really work on liver function. Those are the things that I take regularly. Cod liver oil, I take once in a while. Oftentimes I will forget, but I have it. So I take it, but I'm not all worked up about it. I eat sardines, so I'm not so like concerned that I gotta get my fish oil every day. I mean, there's other things that I may take on a kind of as-needed basis, but those are my cores,
bitters,
right? Those
I've
are
heard you talk
bitters,
about bitters.
So yeah, I will use bitters, but that's more like in the herb, the liver herbs that I use.
Okay.
I have bitter things in there.
And you make your own bread, which is a vitamin B something. Isn't there something natural when you make your own bread?
Yeah.
Vitamin B?
Do I make my own bread? Do I make my own bread? Did I tell you that?
I thought you did. Or you said that you buy a very particular kind of bread that's...
Well, there's Ezekiel bread, but I don't really buy... I buy the dark German rye bread. That's the one that I like that comes in... It's like a brick.
Right, right. Okay,
yeah, that's
so
what
maybe
I
misunderstood you, that you made...
I'd like to make bread,
maybe,
but that's
what you said, yeah. All right, we have 1 minute left, and I would love to tell you about Paul Rattay, the Skeptical Naturopath's year-long lecture series. We're heading into the third lecture, and the overarching title of these lectures is Obstacles to Cure. So every second Saturday morning of the month, from 8:30 until 10 a.m. at the Commons on Jefferson Street in Viroqua, Paul Rattay will head a Q&A for the first half an hour and then give a one-hour lecture. So the next one coming up is Saturday, March 11th. This is free. And the topic will be refined carbohydrates, the art of concentrating empty calories. Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Christina.
Have a good one.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.